Okay, great. Good morning. We're gonna start on time this morning. Thank you all very much. Can you hear me now? If I get right on top of this thing, all right. I never was a big fan of Don Ho, but we'll have to work on this. I'm Rick Barton. I'm the co-director with Karen Von Hippel of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project here at CSIS on behalf of John Hamry, our president, and Steve Flanagan, our new head of the International Security Program. I'd like to welcome all of you today and thank you for coming, for your continuing interest in Afghanistan and on these issues. I think we've really got a good conversation set up. I haven't had a chance to remind each of our speakers that they will have about 10 minutes, so that way we will have more time for the discussion with each of you. I'd like to, in particular, thank the World Food Program for helping us put this program together today. Seema Patel from our team, who many of you know, for her terrific work on our report, Breaking Point, that many of you have already seen and read. Steve Ross, her colleague, and Siamese twin on this work. Owen Anderson, Pete DiMario, who are interns in our office this summer, and Shannon Hayden, who really keeps everything going on a regular basis. We're obviously in a rapidly changing environment, which is presenting a series of daunting challenges. And for over a decade, the U.S. and the international community have been struggling with a series of tough questions. How do we deliver humanitarian assistance in conflict zones? Who should play what roles? What is happening to traditional principles? Is the mission creep everywhere? What is the impact of hearts and minds campaigns? How do we provide care and protection in a place where safety and traditional rules do not exist? What new approaches are emerging, and how promising are they? Today's panel will take up these questions, hopefully answer them in a definitive form so we don't have to continue the next decade of discussion, and really look at it from the view of working with the military, with NGOs, with the host government, with development organizations, and really the whole series of players in this broadening canvas that we've seen. Just brief introductions. Rick Cosino will speak first. He has spent 15 years with the World Food Program, most recently as their country director in North Korea and Angola, and since last July in Afghanistan. Eric Meisner was the first USAID non-Kinetic advisor to the Combined Special Operations Task Force Afghanistan from 2005 to 2007, and he deployed with the special operations teams in Taliban-dominated parts of Afghanistan. He previously worked for USAID's Office of Transition Initiatives in Serbia and Iraq and was a member of the DART team in Darfur. John Patton is currently the Senior Program Development Officer with International Medical Corps and deals with civil military issues and the NGO interface in conflict environments. Previously, from 2005 to 2006, he was USAID's Regional Development Advisor for Southern Afghanistan, based at the regional command in Kandahar, where he managed programming in four southern provinces and field officers at the PRTs after having spent the 2004-2005 period at the Kandahar PRT. He spent a total of 3.5 years in Afghanistan, including time with an NGO in Mazar from late 2001 to mid-2003. Kim Maynard is an older friend and of mine, not in age, and an advisor to USAID, the World Bank, and a firefighter. She's just completed a study for the International Rescue Committee on their approach to Afghanistan's National Solidarity Program, a program which our report spoke highly of. In it, she emphasizes the community-driven reconstruction as a cornerstone of IRC's work, something that I had a chance to work with IRC on an experimental basis in Bosnia and Rwanda in the early mid-1990s. It's good to have all of you here today. They will speak in the order of their introductions, and we look forward to the conversation with you in about 40 minutes, and I'll try to be, I'll probably be a little bit insistent as you get near that 10 to 12 minute mark. Thanks very much.
Okay. Is that okay? Good. Anyway, thank you for the invitation. I very much appreciate this opportunity. I'm not sure that I'll be able to even come close to answering a lot of the questions that were raised in the introduction today, but what I will try to do is speak very briefly about the context that we are working in, the World Food Program. Talk about what has happened over the past 18 months in particular, which a little bit predates my arrival there, but a period that I think is fairly important in the in the rate of change that has occurred over that time, and then speak briefly about our interface and our work together as a UN agency with the ISAF and with the PRTs. Okay, for those of you who don't know, WFP, we're about a $3 billion organization per year. We're working around the world in 85 or so countries. Our mandate is a little bit different. Sometimes it's confused with FAO. FAO is mainly responsible for improving agricultural production. We are a food aid agency. We try to use food in situations to help poor people and help food insecure people. We've been working in Afghanistan since the 1960s, a very long time there, with virtually no interruption during that. And, of course, our programs have evolved over those years. The most recent one is the program that is we're halfway through right now. It's 3 years. It runs from beginning of 06 through the end of 08. And it has this combination of recovery activities and relief. The predominant part of it, as it was defined, was the recovery. The sort of relief things we do there are the seasonal response to spring and autumn flooding, drought pockets, which typically occur throughout the country. Most recently, there's been the issue of IDPs have been displaced by fighting, particularly in southern provinces. And, of course, over the past 6 weeks, deportees from Iran. The kind of recovery things we do are longer-term, mainly incentive-type programs to encourage children back into school or encourage their parents to send them back into school. Literacy programs for females and disadvantaged people, and incentives again for tuberculosis patients to take their full course of their recovery. We have programs, activities in all 34 provinces, and we work within the broad frame of UNAMA. There are a few other agencies like us who have this fairly broad scope of activity, namely UNICEF and WHO. Okay, the past 18 months, we've seen some important things changing. My colleagues were kind enough to bring these two maps. These are produced by UNDSS, the Safety and Security Department of the UN. Particular to note are the red areas, which are areas where, as UN staff members, we are not permitted to work. We're not permitted to travel. We can implement programs there, but we cannot travel there. I didn't do an exact calculation, but my colleagues tell me it's something. It's changed from about 10% of the country in January of 2007 to about 25% of the country now, particularly in the southern and southeast portions of Afghanistan. This is one thing that certainly is evolving rapidly and impacting our operations. Some of the other things include the fighting in the country that is creates from time to time temporary displaced persons. Almost by definition, in most cases, they are displaced to places where we cannot access direct. The influx of deportees from Iran also have tended to go into parts of the country where we have, if not, we don't have perfect access. In many cases, we can reach them, but it is difficult to get to them. They're mainly in Farah and Nimruz province. 100,000 so far in the past 6 weeks. We are trying different ways to implement our programs. As I say, we have activities in 34 provinces, but we are not able to get to many of these, and so we're looking at various modalities to ensure the integrity and credibility of the implementation. particularly important to us. Food aid is a little bit different than some of the other assistance packages in the sense that when you're implementing in a community, you somehow can, in many cases, assure some security of your endeavors. You work through your implementing partners, you work through communities, community elders, you even work through some of your commercial contractors to ensure that what you're doing is relatively secure. You know before you go that things can probably work. Problem with food is it has to move throughout the country. As an example, in 2007, 40% of all of our food will have to move up from the southern part of Kandahar, crossing the Pakistan border at Spin Boldak, through Kandahar, through Farah province, and to the southwest and west of the country. That's 40% of about 250,000 tons. And it's passing through the southern ring road that has been particularly dangerous for us over the past couple months. As an example of that, we've recorded 24 incidents against our commercial vehicles in the past 12 months. 12 of those, half, have been in the past 2 months. So things are very hot at the moment. We've had to completely stop using the ring road about a week ago. We may resume again in the next 2 days. There's increased lawlessness in many of these areas that are proximity to where the fighting is going on. And maybe a little bit on the slightly positive side, we have seen some improvement in government administrative implementation capacity at the provincial and district level, but we've also seen probably more of an increase in corruption. The PRT, the work with the PRTs, I'm not sure if this number is correct, but it's fairly close. I think there are 23 PRTs around the country that we're working with. There are about 10 different nationalities. Each operates a little bit differently, has different mandate, has different budget. We've seen, again, I'm still talking about things that have evolved over the past 18 months, we've seen what seems to be an increasing amount of resources that are being put through the PRTs. We have seen on the positive side that the PRTs are becoming more integrated in some important things that, from our perspective. In particular, we note the work with the provincial disaster response committees in which I find that in many cases the integration of the PRTs in these has been very, very helpful, particularly dealing with these localized floods that we've seen over the past several months. There's a huge increase in the willingness, again, my perspective, of the ISAF and PRT to engage the remainder of the community. I counted something like 10 formal interfaces that are in place right now and dozens of informal ones in which the United Nations and the PRTs get together on a regular basis. And, of course, we see that the PRTs, again, seem to be gaining credibility with the countries that are sponsoring them. They're becoming a more credible eye and ear in the field because they have access to places where some of the other players do not have. But on the other hand, we see that the PRTs are increasingly engaged in kinetic type of activity. So that kind of summarizes the context from our perspective. Some of the conclusions, some of the difficulties we're facing in this relationship. We know that the PRTs are two-headed in many cases, the military and the other part of it, in which the military seems to be the larger, the more predominant, more visible head of the two. They get the more attention and are often more dominated by that side of the brain. I'm not sure if it's the left or the right. ISAF and the PRTs certainly have a military approach in most recent meetings that I've been attending that bring the two parties together. We see that the discussion is about a campaign, a very military term in which partners, allies are brought into the fray, the UN agencies in this particular case. We know that from a humanitarian and development perspective, often Because of this two-headedness of the entity, we see that many of the interventions can be, seem to be, short-term in nature. Their appeasement, their heart and mind type of activities, rewarding of good behavior. Even in some cases, perhaps doing things that have a military logistics benefit for the military. There's maybe not the skills in many of the PRTs to identify real need from perceived need. There are often reactions by individuals that have resources to spend on anecdotal or very limited evidence in which they then act. Changes, the interventions that we've seen have often been outside of the larger scope of what the government's strategic plans are, although we see that these are changing. There's been more of a short-term horizon in type of interventions. And, of course, there's the common complaint I think everyone shares that the quick rotation of individuals involved in PRTs and the ISAF in general is very fast, therefore losing any institutional knowledge. Another common complaint we've had is there's been and this is, I'm sure, justified in many ways, but there's a unwillingness to share advanced information about operational intentions, which could in some ways allow a more prepared response by humanitarian agencies. On the plus side, we've seen that PRTs can go to areas that some of the traditional agencies cannot go. In many cases, and my organization has benefited from this in a couple cases, they do can bring complementary resources. One of the things we can bring is food, but we get very little cash to do much else with the food. The PRT in some cases have been able to bring cash or materiel to enhance and to kind of bring a synergy, the use of the food that we do bring. I mentioned the integral participation in the disaster response initiatives at the provincial level. And, of course, in many cases, there is a very considerable logistics capability that can be brought into play from time to time. Amazing thing that I've noticed about the dealing with ISAF and PRT is that it seems to be very much of a learning entity, a body. It recognizes when it makes mistakes and it tries to do things better all the time. This increased interface and dialogue with the UN agencies is certainly part of that. I heard a week or two ago that this current discussion that's going on in the country about subnational development plans, ISAF is going to assign an individual to attend every one of the sectoral discussions so that they have that information coming back to them. And from a selfish point of view, we have 9 sub-offices, area offices around the country. It's very comforting to know that there is a possibility of an extremist support for my staff who are out there. So on balance, I just want to say that, this is a reality. It is out there. It's growing. It cannot be ignored. There is a very important difference between the sort of interface we can have and do with the PRT in a kinetic area and in a secure area. We have done some wonderful work in some of the more secure areas in which we've actually used PRT air assets to move food into places that we simply couldn't reach with our own capacities very quickly, particularly during these past spring floods. And looking forward, I think that one of the things we would probably like to see is the PRTs participating more focused on the enabling environment for what we're doing, and not in isolation either. I mean, there is the ANA and there is the ANP out there, the Army and the police, that have some capacity and increasing capacity in many areas. We would like to see the focus mainly on enabling, maybe helping remove some of the red from the maps if possible. And there is a really important role to play in the rapid onset type of emergency response that no one else can do better than the PRTs. And finally, it would be good to, if the if there is a continued move towards the type of intervention that we see, and that's beyond the quick intervention, quick reaction interventions with small amounts of money using larger amounts of money, then it's imperative that it be done within this broad framework of the National Development Strategy of Afghanistan. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Rick. Let me just, I'm going to just play with this a bit. Is that improve it at all? Does that increase the volume that way? Okay. If you could each of you push this thing all the way over. I did want to mention one other thing. This this program will be broadcast on the CSIS website and on our PCRproject.com blog afterwards, so that those of you who want to forward this to family members who are not able to be here today should be able to do that as well. Thanks very much, Rick. And Eric, why don't you go next?
Can everybody hear me? All right. Good sign. Well, thanks, Rick. It was very enlightening. I have fond memories of WFP in Darfur. You were one of few UN offices that really stepped out and were forward-leaning, incredibly operational, and many of your, especially your operational security staff, were incredibly daring in reaching areas that were not yet deemed impermissive in West Darfur, but were, and Tekor just didn't get there yet. So I definitely am a big fan. I regrettably didn't encounter WFP in Afghanistan. They were next to one of our compounds in Kabul. We rarely saw them, though, the military and the UN. But let me just start by saying, giving a little explanation of who I am. I'm a little confusing in terms of the title that was given. My former job that I recently left is the non-kinetic advisor to the Combined Joint Special Operations Task Force, Afghanistan, otherwise known as CJ SOTF in Afghanistan. I don't know if many of you have encountered elements of CJ SOTF. I'm highly doubtful that you probably have. You may have seen it but didn't realize it. Back in 2004, CJ SOTF, which is the Joint Special Ops Task Force, as you can read literally into its name, Navy SEALs, Green Berets, Coalition, Special Operators, we had Norwegians, British, French, Italians, you name it, were part of CJ SOTF. Over time, as ISAF took more and more control over the country, membership, coalition membership, and the CJ SOTF declined. We only have a few partners now, such as the United Arab Emirates, and when I say we, I'm talking about the past we. I'm not with them anymore. And its role in Afghanistan has evolved. Without getting too much into what CJ SOTF's down and dirty mission is in Afghanistan, they do have what we call a Foreign Internal Defense Objective, FID. Those of you that are familiar with the DoD community know what that means. I'm not going to really get into that too much, aside from, once again, you can interpret that very literally. They work with the security sector, but also the one nice thing about special operations from a civilian dealing with the military is that special operations is really trained to understand the non-lethal aspect of stability operations. And when I say non-lethal, once again, this is exactly what it sounds like. A lot of people have images of special forces knocking down doors, being in Mogadishu, taking out high-value targets. Sure, they do that, but they also are concerned with helping foster stability through the government and Afghan national security forces in very remote areas beyond the reach of ISAF and beyond the reach of conventional coalition forces. They are part of the coalition, so to speak. They're not part of ISAF. They have an independent mission of ISAF. They're in virtually every province of the country. So as ISAF has expanded and coalition forces, conventional, have contracted to the east, CJ SOTF remains, in fact, maybe even has an increased presence, but that would just be a guess, in many parts of the country. CJ SOTF asked for a USAID asset in 2004. They got one, me, in 2005. Once again, I'm going to use a lot of military jargon. I've been kind of brainwashed, drank the Kool-Aid. I've strayed a little from my days with UMCOR and the DART. As you may guess, but they recognized as they were out in a lot of these remote areas, which happened to be virtually every red area that you can see up there, This is why I never saw WFP or NGOs, despite my affinity for them, and desperately begging for them in Kabul to come down. They operate in all those areas. They also happen to operate. I know the flavor today is PRTs. I can't speak about PRTs. I never worked on a PRT. I helped PRTs get out to areas where they were struggling to get out to. So this is even beyond the PRT. We have this image of the PRT kind of being out and being able to reach all the semi-non-permissive areas. This is also a bit of a myth. They are also bound operationally with the force protection assets they have, et cetera, and how far they can go. There's certain areas of the country where we have vulnerable populations that are just not being reached. Happens to be that where these vulnerable populations are also, in most cases, happen to be where the Taliban and other elements deemed by the U.S. military and U.S. government as the enemy, and that's a big catchphrase, also are, in terms of setting up haven and often exploiting these populations to recruit young fighters, unemployed, those that are not being reached by the NGO sector, those that are struggling with access to food, and jobs. All these populations are being exploited by the Taliban and other elements as part of the recruitment base. So meanwhile, in its old counterterrorism and now foreign internal defense objective, special forces teams out in these areas are standing alone. Unlike conventional forces, all due respect to those in the room that are with the conventional military, special operations just to understand the role of USAID and the UN and others. And to borrow their parlance, they realized this came from the head elements in SOCOM and other parts of the military that they can't play whack-a-mole forever. They recognize that lethal action has its limits and, in fact, actually creates animosity in the host population actually is self-defeating in the end, unless the humanitarian development reconstruction side actually comes in to their space. The irony is it's all red. And so we're faced with a bit of a conundrum. We have elements that are very supportive of the civilian and humanitarian sector to come out and assist in working with the populations in helping with food assistance and development and projects. They don't want to be in this business. Trust me. Those that are in the room that are in the military, I'm not going to speak for them, but I'm going to just take a leap and guess, and please chime in during the Q&A. They don't want to be doing this. They don't want to be encroaching in the humanitarian space. They rather traditional actors do it. It gets really confusing for the military to be getting involved in this. And I think it's one of the stereotypes that I think is a bit unfair about the military, that when they're standing alone in an area, and that, and obviously my biases are coming through in the statements I'm making right now, but having been out there myself as USAID, trying to get USAID projects and implementers out to these areas with the assistance of special forces, and just largely banging my head against the wall because of the security situation, and or even if it's a bit of a myth and you can't operate there, there's this perception based on maps like this that you can't operate there. The red areas are red for a reason, but not all areas within the red areas are red. And there are opportunities for civilian actors to work there. However, because they're not out there, they can't identify those areas. And we just have a cyclical problem. Once again, I haven't worked for a PRT. I've just been out to virtually every bad place out there right now where the condition of the people are just mind-boggling in terms of the humanitarian situation. And so I've heard it all within aid about the military handing out humanitarian assistance, food, blankets. What should they be doing it? Should they not be? But at the end of the day, we look at each other, U.S. government, civilian, such as myself, former, and the military, and just wonder, when are people coming? You've heard this over and over again from PRTs. I know it's not that simple. Rick mentioned the problem and the conundrum they're facing, and that they're exploring modalities to get out there. I would definitely be interested in learning more about those. But the reality is that we at that time were standing alone. For the 18, 19 months that I was out there, remotest areas, We never once saw an NGO, never once saw anybody from the United Nations. And despite the fact that we'd come back to Kabul and beg for people to come out, even put them on a helicopter. Once somebody from UNAMA and Gardez came down, and I won't mention him by name, but he was definitely an exception. I definitely applauded him. He wanted to at least get eyes on the situation to verify our claims that there was humanitarian space. But right now we have this that operational reality out there. I'm going to just wrap up by mentioning that I'm taking kind of a strong line in my statement just to, not for the sake that I'm trying to bash the NGO sector out there. Hardly. I know what the NGO and humanitarian sector is facing. But I also want to balance out Rick's perspective for the audience. And I'm going to stop talking soon so we can get through this, because I also, I hope all the panelists did this as well. And I try to make sure that we have some interesting representation in the room. And we've got people that have been out there, I'm making eye contact with several of them, that can speak about PRTs with a lot more authority than I can speak about the Special Forces perspective, and can speak about the military perspective. These are the people I brought to the table today. Hopefully there's other sectors here. I'd love for the dialogue to expand beyond this table, because clearly we have, at least John and I, we have very little slices of the bigger pie in Afghanistan, and definitely can't represent the full spectrum of reality out there. Just can share with you what we experienced and what we saw, and the conclusions that we reached for our own specific areas. So that's it. Thanks.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me okay? All right. Let me pick up where Eric left off. A lot of themes are coming out here. What I'd like to do is also be a bit brief, discuss some of the themes that I saw in my particular experience, and then very interested to hear what issues are important to you that we can speak to as well. There's numerous debates out there in humanitarian practice from the donor community, from the military lanes. We're aware of all of these debates and the different lanes those take, and the interconnected nature that we crossed this in our areas of operation. I was also in the south, in the ostensibly red areas. I agree with what Eric said. There are pockets of security and insecurity in which you can operate. There's a lot of good writing, actually, as part of counterinsurgency strategy by the military. How do you partner with the interagency lane or with NGOs, and how can you actually provide some services? The actual writing on that, it is not bad. It's pretty good, actually. Putting that into practice in a very difficult kinetic environment, which takes precedence because of immediate military or political imperatives on the ground, changes the nature of that a little bit. And oddly enough, you may find it odd to see that we actually did have productive relationships with special forces. And myself as well, and some of my field officers had this experience as well. For example, we did go along the Pakistani border in some of the districts south of Spinboldock in Kandahar. Part of the PRT goal was stabilization of these areas and allowing a climate to grow where the GOA, a legitimate government of Afghanistan, could take effect. We thought the way to do that, in part, was to discuss with various villages and elders in these areas that were not reached by the GOA, by development, by the humanitarian actors. What we found, and I'm speaking from the U.S. government, we had foreign policy objectives and all, and I'll speak to the disconnects, even within USAID that we saw at the field level and at the Kabul level. But one approach that we were trying to do in the field was actually talk to influential leaders. And by that, I don't necessarily mean power brokers. Because of our proximity, what we were trying to do, we had to talk to governors. We had to talk to often corrupt district or provincial leaders. But there are people out in districts in the provinces that do not have a political stake in that race other than their areas that we don't know about, and they don't know us. That's why the approach of building relationships at the very local level is of primary importance. A good colleague of mine called these people opinion leaders, where they might be able to also influence their sphere. Because as I said, they didn't know who we are or what we were about. And when other groups, you can label those Taliban, but that's, you know, who's Taliban? I mean, there's people that are, you know, pushed into it or ideologues. There are other people that are, you know, pulled into it by sharing, you know, similar cultural values that, you know, are reached by some of those messages that say, you know, that the people are able to influence that. I think in military parlance they call it people sitting on the fence. But there are people that can be reached, and even with minimal assistance, and we found this going in with the special forces, as Eric said, they came to us directly and said, we're going to get no mileage in kicking in doors here. We actually, in the true sense of interagency partnership or assistance, we need you guys to go out and actually talk to people and see what the needs are. And I think the local population, which I call the center of gravity, is sometimes missing from that dynamic. And we had some good limited success with that until priorities change, people are pulled out, you know, even SF groups go to different areas. One of the themes that came to us glaringly, and I'm talking as a USAID field officer, was the funding cycle and the non-predictability of funds from year to year, which the local population was very in tune with. And it was hard to get that buy-in that we were talking about for the GOA or for what we were trying to do if they felt, well, you guys are going to be here or you're going to be gone from here in a year, which is, in effect, what happened in these areas. I'm thankful that we got some of these projects that were prioritized and important to the people on the ground, that we got some of those done, but it does show the changing nature of that. There was, I don't want to say disconnect exactly, but there are different lanes that need to operate at the same time. From the USAID office in Kabul, trying to do a traditional mission with traditional sector offices, whether health or econ or whatever, the long-term strategy is necessary. I think a lot of people would agree that this is a 20-year context, maybe, that we have to be engaged, we have to have commitment, we have to have the funding levels. So that can be done. You know, at the same time, we were pushing for funding or funding cycles that were more immediate. And I think this came out through other donor governments. This came out through NGOs as well. It would be nice to have smaller infusions of money that we had access to immediately, that was not delaying things through the winter or through a different season, where we can actually get on the ground, affect some change according to the priorities of the local population. And, you know, even with minimal assistance there, as I said, you know, it can have some effect. In some circles, people will say, well, the military should just work on SSR, on security sector reform. I think that debate needs to be a little bit more nuanced, because I think you tend to run a risk of that sector becoming too powerful a player or unbalanced, or being seen as you're actually supporting district leaders that actually might be corrupt. So some of these lanes have to occur at the same time. There are places for the larger infrastructure projects, district government buildings and such, but that won't be the end-all to development in these areas where NGOs and others have not reached yet. You do have to have contact with the local population. The military actually, and I agree with Eric's statement, that we're proactive in trying to seek NGO support and bring NGOs back into these non-permissive areas. And that's a challenge. I mean, there are different cultural languages, there are differences, but I think one of the most important themes that I found was that we need engagement on these issues and collaboration, because if you're not sitting at the table there, you won't have a seat at the table with provincial governors. DOD has, as you know, grown in prominence over the last 10 years in funding and staffing and logistics. That will not change, and that will continue to do so, and the military's own doctrine will state, even though we would like the interagency to take control of this, we will fill a vacuum if the civilians aren't there. So there are ways to engage in this discussion in a balanced fashion where it's not compromising various parties' principles, and I don't either want to oversimplify this or just throw out too many bullet points. Some of that discussion can come from you. But that discussion, that engagement is taking place, and that is important. It's also our job, and I saw this as my job, to also train the military on how you speak to the NGO community or the donor community, what might be effective and what might not be in the effect of using language that says we're going to coordinate this context or this theater. That got short shrift with the NGOs, and that wasn't going to be effective. But people, you know, because the cultures and the languages are different, people will, when you actually have that discussion, then they'll say, oh, okay, I see, we're, you know, have slightly different languages there. So we did have some some progress on that, and I think the debate in our field, in the NGO community, has developed vastly over the last 10 years, not just in practice, but on these issues and the discussion. Let me actually stop there. I'd like to let Kim jump in, and then I'm interested to see what kind of points are of interest to you for the discussion.
Thanks very much.
Thanks. Already this is great. I mean, lots of things to be thinking about, and I'm sure you have plenty to add to the discussion. Taking sort of this whole genre of points that have been made, everything from military to the humanitarian to the actual, as Rick brought up, you know, what is the role of humanitarianism today, and are we jeopardizing the values of humanitarianism and so forth? I just want to throw out something that's slightly puts the whole question on its head. More and more humanitarianism is putting participation into its relief operations. And there's a greater holistic approach to these contexts. We're looking at sort of the longer term a little bit more, and we're integrating with more different types of organizations, and certainly all the discussion about the population itself is part of the parlance. So I want to throw out, as Rick said earlier, the possibility of a new tool. And it's really not new, and it comes from the development field. And I'm coming from the humanitarian field, you know, have been somewhat allergic to some of those kinds of things. But I think this thing deserves a lot more attention than it has been given, and certainly a lot more application. And that is community-driven reconstruction, which is just simply a term, and it's used in a lot of different ways through different organizations. But we'll use that term for now, CDR, community-driven reconstruction. One is, especially in these contexts, I think it addresses the key, has the potential in any case, to address the key humanitarian needs as determined by the population itself. It also builds that foundation for governance for the long-term transition from the beginning, and it also can contribute to stability and security. And those are three pretty heady potentials there. Now, given that there's not huge amount of research out there, there is some, and IRC, International Rescue Committee, was specifically interested in the National Solidarity Program, which is this community-driven reconstruction program in Afghanistan, and they wanted to look at it. So they hired me to look at that, and particularly look at IRC's operations in the southeast, in Khost and Logar. And as you know, Khost is one of the tougher provinces to be working in, and Logar, parts of Logar, not so easy in and of itself. So what's the value of community-driven reconstruction? What it does, as I say, is it turns everything on its head. It puts the resources and the financial resources and the decision-making to the population. Rather than us determining what the needs are, what the issues are, and what the desires are, it asks the population for that. And then, as a demand-led instrument, it maximizes the participation. So it's at the extreme end of the participation spectrum. By focusing all of it on the contribution of the community, the decisions of the community, and the management of the community, it takes away all of what we've just been talking about, to some extent, on the NGOs, the UN, and so forth. Obviously, there's a huge role there for international community in facilitating the process. The process is, very, very briefly, is essentially after determining the location, there's a election process within the communities where they elect up to a committee that is community development councils or something of that nature, but in Afghanistan it's community development council. So they get the experience of a secret election firsthand right in their community, and they have to think about it and discuss what does it mean to elect somebody. What is leadership and so forth. They then decide what their priorities are, what their issues are, but also who they are as a community. Do they have returnees? Do they have Taliban? Are they agitated? Are they disgruntled with the central government? What is their sort of focus? And it could be many. And therefore, what do they want to do? So what are their priorities out of that? What kind of projects? And then given a block grant, a certain amount of money to which they decide which of these, which ones they're going to prioritize, which one they're going to do first and so forth, out of that amount of money. In Afghanistan, that's $200 a family, which is a lot. I mean, it can be, you know, $60,000 for a community, which is a significant amount of money, much more than most communities have seen at any one time, and certainly a lot more than they've had responsibility to handle, which is a whole part of the conversation about capacity and you know, and learning and so forth. And then they implement the project through community contribution. They have to supply either labor, money, or physical resources to the projects themselves. And that's another way of getting people to work together. It's part of the decision-making process, but it's also the implementing. So they're out there actually physically working together. So the National Solidarity Program in Afghanistan is a really interesting case of this because it's countrywide. Every single person in Afghanistan, presumably, will have had been exposed to this process. The election process, the group decision-making, the accountability for finances, the addressing needs, the working together, and so forth, which is significant. And for many people, it's the first time they've ever done anything with elections, so it's the first experience of it. It's so far, they've gone about a little over 50%. And, of course, like all programs, start off with the easiest places, and it's getting harder and harder, more difficult. And there is a qualification for security. But I have to say they're working in some extremely insecure areas and ones that have become more insecure but are continuing the program. So a lot of places where international NGOs cannot go, UN cannot go, where perhaps special forces do go, are places where the NSP is working. And there are community development councils, and they're continuing their projects as we go. IRC internationals, for example, have not been into host to look at the NSP, I believe, for probably 2 years. But the program is very strong and up and running, and it's had some significant impact, which I'll talk about. There are 24 facilitating partners for the NSP, which is usually pretty much geographically based. And so IRC is in Logan Host and expanding to Nangarhar and Paktia. And so IRC is just one. And there's different types of implementation processes, but they all follow an operations manual, you know, procedures and so forth. What's interesting that comes out of this is the number one need that that the communities come up with is not roads, but it's water. Water and sanitation programs. Roads are number two. But the cost effectiveness of this kind of a program is extensive. It's 63% of all the program money goes directly into the projects. And again, that's partly because of the methodology of it, but it's also because they've designed it that way, so that the overhead costs are quite small. And this is known by the population. They say, it's all over the place, saying, you know, we like NSP because we're the ones getting the money. You know, it's not those internationals out there stealing from us. There's also very low corruption and misappropriation, extremely low. And there's a tendency within CDR as a program or as an approach that the lower you go, the less corruption. And so here at the community level, there's very low corruption reported. Now, that's a difficult statistic to get to, but there's a report out recently of looking at specifically that, and they found little, so, you know, whatever that means. It also builds linkages between the population and the government, because the government has to, one, approve of the projects, of course. If it's a healthcare center, they need to know that it's going to be funded and continued maintenance and so forth. But also, the government tends to be, especially in IRC areas, or I know for a fact in IRC areas and presumably in others as well, a great deal of interaction. So the government officials come and monitor the project. They look at the bridge as it's being built. They participate in the discussions. If there's an issue, they try and help problem solve. And so there's this now this sort of handshake to a government that never existed in their minds before. And obviously in Afghanistan, that's, well, who is the government? And what at what local level? Because there's a big gap at the district level. And I was there last in the fall, so I know things have evolved a little bit, but essentially that's it's a big plus, is that relationship between the government and the population. And since this is run by the Ministry of Rural Rehabilitation Development, it puts the government in a positive light. So people say, oh, yeah, we don't like the government, but we like NSP. So, and the other thing it creates a alternative leadership. So when they elect people up, presumably, and what we found in IRC area is that a significant number of people who are elected to the CDCs are not the warlords, or even the political leaders, or even the maliks, the traditional elders, and so forth. They're actually farmers and combination of people. So the people who were engaged the most in the conflict have often a role, but they're set aside from this continuing to direct the community's development needs. I'll just talk very quickly. I have a couple more minutes. Just quickly on IRC's approach specifically. IRC, well, first of all, Mullah Omar from Hezbi Islami, from the Taliban, but also Hezbi Islami are based in Khost. So there's a very incredibly strong resistance to both the foreigners and to the central government. And Mullah Omar said at the beginning of this program, right when IRC was being handed Khost and Logar as their provinces to work in, said, we will have no foreigners and we will have nothing to do with the central government, and anybody dealing with either one of us is going to be killed right on the spot. So IRC walked into the situation with that, and they found that what they needed to do was be extremely consultative, which is the nature of Afghan culture. So they established advisory boards, which were a combination of all these people who had been fighting, the political leaders, the tribal leaders, there were some women, the Kuchi, and so forth, who had to work together and advise IRC. So they helped in select what communities were going to be allocated, NSP next, and so forth, which was significant in and of itself. And they also engaged religious leaders to discuss Islam and development, and what is the role, and what does the Quran say about Islam, and women's participation. And therefore created greater acceptance among the population as this is a legitimate way to go. So I just want to leave you with two thoughts on this. IRC's approach in particular seemed to have a very special impact. One is the security within those two regions and the stability, and it seems to be pretty hefty. There's very few incidences and no incidences against IRC, which is something to say in some of the more difficult areas. And the second thing is CDR as a methodology and a tool, I think, puts all of this back to us as we've just been discussing. How do we approach these difficult places? How do we approach this transition? How do we take it, as an interest in directing our efforts towards the needs of the population to the next step? It's how do the population begin to engage in its own recovery? And I'll leave it at that. I think I'd be very interested in people's either experience of NSP or thought of it as part of the process within a general conflict environment, which is what we're all discussing here. And it's not a panacea, and there are a lot of issues that are still on the table with it, but I want to just sort of throw that out as an option.
Thank you. Great. Well, thank you all. I think, as usually happens when we have people who've had a lot of time in the field, that you get a lot of sensible comments and really rather practical insights, and certainly this panel has offered those. What I'd like to do now is to turn to all of you, just to get a sense of this audience, if we could. How many people here have been in Afghanistan in the last 5 years? Just for so maybe about a third or a quarter of this group. And how many of you have been working on Afghanistan, but not necessarily travel there as well? Just that includes the people who've traveled there. So I just get a slightly. So yeah, okay. Well, then I'm sure many of you are really familiar with many of the comments that have been mentioned here. When we go to the questions, if any of you need seats up front, there are four more seats in here. If you want to be part of the conversation, just feel free to come forward. But when you do stand up to speak, if you would, just mention your name and where you're from. I think we have a microphone here, which we're hoping will then pick up your question for the broadcast. So if you would wait for Pete to get to you, he can see. We'll just sort of work neighborhoods and work across the room. Pete, why don't you come over here, and we'll start on this side of the room and work back that way. George looks like he's ready to go dead center in the back here. And then we'll go to your neighbor and then come forward here to Seema and then sweep across the room.
Thanks very much, Rick. My name is George Devendorf. I work with Mercy Corps, an NGO that's been working inside Afghanistan for about 20 years. Thank you to all the panelists. Excellent presentations. Very much appreciate that. There was a good deal of discussion about accessibility inside Afghanistan today and the various factors that go into that. Kim also oriented us towards one successful approach to establishing but then also maintaining and continuing community-based reconstruction and assistance in those kind of environments. And I just wanted to comment on that. NSP and other programs that adopt similar methodology of community-based or community-driven development and reconstruction work, they're successful inside Afghanistan today in those areas where the local entities, official and unofficial, welcome or at least see some value in those operations continuing. And I guess that's a fairly obvious statement. NGOs are the ultimate soft target. If those who wanted to disrupt relief and development activities inside the country wanted to, they could shut down those operations very, very quickly in any given area at any time. So it stands to reason that where it's successful, it's largely successful because the community leaders, representatives, and other power brokers see value in it. And that's been a critical factor because in many of these areas, particularly in the south and the east where Mercy Corps and the other NGOs here, many of them work, these are areas that are pervaded by various actors, Taliban Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3, other armed opposition groups, and others. And so by way of example, in Helmand, where Mercy Corps has been working for quite some time, in 2003 we were operational in every district inside the province. Today we're down to two districts surrounding Lashkargah, the capital. And the primary reason why we've seen that contraction in our own ability to operate is because our relationships with various folks in different districts has changed fundamentally in the last several years. In the districts where we're still operating, those, frankly, Taliban leaders who are local Taliban leaders, they know us. They've seen us around before. They've seen us for 20 years. They welcome our work and what we're trying to do there. In those other districts, those that we've had to pull back from, we have different ways to describe it, but you have expat Taliban. You have various Taliban who are not from the local area that don't necessarily recognize who Mercy Corps or an NGO is, or recognize them but see them in a very different light, see them opportunistically. It's in those areas where we cannot operate effectively these days. Last year, about 26 NGO workers were killed working inside Afghanistan. This year, almost halfway through the year, mercifully that number is down to 3. At first glance, that's a wonderful indicator of improved security around the country. Unfortunately, it really belies the reality, and that is NGOs have contracted and moved away from the most dangerous areas because of the casualties that they've incurred in recent years. And they're also just much, much more careful about where they go, when they go, how they move, and so forth. So the reason why I mention, and this is more of a descriptive comment than necessarily an analytical one, but the reason why I mention it is because when we talk about the need to inject relief and development energy and attention and funding into many of these areas, particularly the red areas. As Eric pointed out, a lot of these areas actually have pink spots within them where some operations are possible. But in the really tough areas, there are fundamental, obstacles to the ability of any relief and development actors to engage in anything resembling more than a one-off contribution to meeting relief and development needs in these critical areas. And I think we just need to keep that in mind, especially as the trend lines and indicators in insecurity are actually increasing, at least those indicators that pertain to and impact the ability of operators, soft operators like NGOs and others, to do their work inside the country, especially in the South and East. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, George. Excellent comment. Anybody want to jump in on that?
Yeah. Thanks for that. That was an excellent point. I just also wanted to mention that in the red areas, I don't want to confuse the audience here, that the last thing we want to do is invite an NGO into an area where they're going to get harmed or hurt. That's going to defeat the whole purpose of our objective. You know, U.S. government, civilians, military, humanitarian sector, UN, that's the last thing we want. Recognizing that when an area is too hot, you can't get in there. We're faced with a problem, however. The reason of the fact that you can't get there, and the blame is definitely not going to be laying on people who are unarmed and are targets. In fact, if you were unarmed and a target and you still went to that area, I'd think you were crazy. But this creates a problem for the military and, say, I can only speak about the U.S. government civilians, on the ground in which a humanitarian vacuum is created. Once again, as John mentioned, the military then will see that vacuum and the fact that it's being exploited by, once again, loosely termed the enemy, but also the fact that conditions are deteriorating for civilians and react. The reason why I'm mentioning that is because I'm hedging my bets that somebody may raise this. It's been raised several times in Afghanistan that the military's involvement in HA, humanitarian assistance distribution, is violating all sorts of principles. In many cases, it should stop, it should be modified, et cetera, et cetera. I just want to create a little understanding of then the other side of the coin in the red areas of the non-NGO field looking out, that they're in a bit of a bind when the actors can't get there. And in those cases, once again, I hate to be repetitive, last thing we're going to do is ask you to come to a red-hot area. That's just going to spark mass panic by any place that's deemed red and defeat the whole purpose to move people to maybe pink areas. But just once again, I think if we start looking at stereotypes and of each other, the different actors out there, and just try to understand the position, for example, in this case the military is in, prior to criticizing them for engaging in humanitarian assistance related efforts, that there's a reason they're doing that. So I just wanted to throw that out there. I know that's going to elicit a response. Thanks.
Let me just try to tie two points together, both from George and Kim, and expanding on yours, Eric. I'll try to do this in less than a minute. How we address some of this issue in the very problematic areas, I very much agree with the points on the NSP. We did try to work through that system, actually worked with UNAMA, worked with NGOs, worked with many people on this issue, had differing degrees of effectiveness in different areas based on capacity, but I think it was something that needed support and needed to go. One way to address George's points as well, how we try to address getting in there, and this didn't hold true just for USG or donor actors, but NGOs as well, is there's been more, we're trying to look more into working with local NGOs and locally based NGOs, meaning if they're in Maruf district of Kandahar, and they are a viable NGO that actually has been vetted through some sort of system, whether it's UN system or just contextual knowledge on the ground. These people knew the communities. We were able to have a very light footprint to the point we actually didn't go out there. We were working through that conduit. It's a way to tie in some things with NSP, the low footprint of some of the international NGOs can actually use local staff, build capacity, but also be mindful that there are some viable locally based NGOs out there.
You know, I still think that at some point, maybe hopefully today, but certainly soon, we need to have a richer discussion about what is an appropriate security risk and how we achieve that. We spend a tremendous amount of time in all of these operations with daily briefings, exchanging information, so-called security experts, people in the field who have a different view, security experts in Kabul. There's a range of practices that are really, I think, are generally dissatisfying. And obviously the fatalities have been increasing almost geometrically. I mean, the 1990s, it was about 190 humanitarian workers in the decade that were killed. And now we're seeing those kinds of numbers annually, basically. Anyway, I'm not satisfied that we've actually reached a very mature level of understanding of what is necessary, what is acceptable, how close you can be. I know that when we set up our own offices in Haiti for AID in 1994, we put them right next to the special forces. We weren't part of the special forces, but they were there. We rented the next building. I mean, that was it was a tactical choice, and it was I think made our people more comfortable. I think back here. Do you have the microphone yet? Oh, Pete's got you there. Thanks.
Olivia Albrecht. I'm with Lockheed Martin, and I know that we've spoken significantly about the kind of final end of the distribution process, but I wonder if there's opportunity for security and technology to help create efficiencies and perhaps avoid some obstacles in the supply chain management process, and whether or not those are fundamental issues that you guys are facing bringing these supplies and humanitarian aid into Afghanistan and then going through the distribution process.
Do you want to take a second and think about it and put another question on the table, or do you want to jump right into that?
I'm not sure what the question
was. Okay.
What did you have in mind?
By technical.
Generating efficiencies from getting the supplies that you are finally distributing in either the green areas or potentially these pink or red areas, if possible, creating greater efficiencies to get the actual physical supplies faster into the country and then into a more organized and efficient fashion, getting them to the distribution centers.
So, and is it the use of technology in particular that you're thinking of, sort of other innovations that you're you're imagining?
Exactly.
So in a way, the question is, what would you like to have at your disposal that is not presently available that would give you greater efficiencies in the delivery of goods to people in need in Afghanistan, I guess. Is that a fair rephrasing?
Yeah. Shall I quickly? Just well, I don't have it either. And as a matter of fact, I was going to apologize. I thought bringing these charts would be very helpful today, but it's kind of hijacked the discussion. The red and the non-red has been... first of all, before I get to that one, I just want to make a comment on the security. Colleagues here at the table have quite rightly said there are red and there are red areas in those swaths of the South. That's certainly true. The whole discussion, it's been going on, I guess, since the Canal Hotel in Iraq, was how much risk is tolerable in operations. And this is certainly a valid comment. If it's a life-saving operation, red area, we can still go in there and do something, first of all. Second of all, just because it's red doesn't mean programs aren't being implemented. As I mentioned, there are other ways to do those programs. It doesn't mean you walk away and just say, it's red, we can't help. We are finding ways to do that. None of them are perfect, and we try to use a combination of them. Enlisting government at the district and provincial level may or may not be suitable. We have third party in terms of national NGOs who also help, and we've also moved into engaging private sector staff hired through the private sector who are not subject to the restrictions of the United Nations for access. Red doesn't mean no go completely. Getting back to this one, I just don't know how to answer that. Food, I can only speak about that, is typically low-value, high-volume commodity, has to travel long distances. There's no other way to move it apart from road vehicles. We've tried different ways to do it by highway, including organizing convoys. Transporters and drivers do not like to operate in convoys, even if they're promised armed escorts by ANA, ANP, or ISAF. They figure they're either more a threat for a disaster at that point or certainly later on. So unless you have some very specific examples how technology can be applied, I can't see it right now myself. Thank you.
Mike Fallon, Foreign Relations. I think the maps are terrific as a representation of the difficulty of reaching areas and the increasing difficulty. My question goes to perhaps the reason it wasn't as read a year and a half ago and prior, and perhaps you can lend some insight, the fellows who've worked with CJTF or CJSOTF. To what extent is the military making informed decisions about relationships with the power brokers in the region, and to what extent have they evolved and improved that so that the access for those trying to reach opinion leaders, trying to deliver humanitarian assistance, is more in tune, more in line with a general increase in security for the populace and not simply for the elites themselves.
Let me take the first question. I think the short answer to that over, say, the period from mid-04 to mid-06 or even earlier there is missed opportunities. I think, especially as the PRT program developed, the relationships that we were trying to build in a variety of lanes at the local level, some of the – there are implied promises there where political assistance, you know, depending on how you frame the discussion. However – In laying that groundwork and some of the relationships we built, then we were trying to do some work in various areas where we thought it would contribute to stabilization of a particular district or province. But back to the funding cycles and the shifting time frames, new frameworks would come down that were, you know, in 30 days or 4 months, we want to do this now. And it take focus away from and funds, quite frankly, of some of the things that we had promised to do, basically. And so we lost a little political capital that way. But I think, missed opportunities is why the reason it slid back, and that we weren't able to engage with those opinion leaders. I'll let you answer part two of the question, but also let me get to that a little bit, because the military has gotten better in some lanes as far as this relationship building. But what happens, I think, a bit is too much focus goes into some of the power brokers that might not have, one, legitimacy for that local population that you're ostensibly trying to help, and two was that some of the projects were actually fueling conflict. We've gone a long way to try to educate some of those partners to say, get out of the lane of schools and clinics. You need to tie into line-level ministries. There are systems there. There are programs like NSP. You don't want to be in that lane. Why? Because then you just have an empty four-walled building with no books, no teachers, no salaries. So we made a lot of headway that way. But at the same time, we did, because of short time frames, changing nature of the rotations or the task forces all come in. You would think there would be more continuity. That issue was addressed, and there really wasn't. A new group comes in. They want to put their own stamp on it, create maybe a parallel framework, which I used to say in the battle update briefs to some of our partners was, look, that gives the illusion of progress where none has occurred. We've been talking about tying into systems. Let's do that. Let's listen to that voice of the local population. And actually, if I could just add one thing to that, because we are also talking about who are the actual appropriate local actors we should talk to. You could go into one district in the South, and you might have three different groups claiming to be the representative shura from that area. So if you just get with one and you put all your eggs in that basket and start funding some projects there, which may or may not be inappropriate, now you've created two more sets of animosity over here. So that dynamic has happened. So it's important to triangulate information by building those relationships long-term to see who is the representatives of that community. And I'll stop there. I don't know if you have...
Yeah, I think just so we can get more questions on the floor, I think you've done a good job of starting to answer that question. And I think it's a very rich conversation. We happen to mention both of those approaches in both of our reports over the last 2 years, and there's been a strong emphasis on exactly what you suggested in both in the balance and in breaking point. So, Why don't we come down? I think there's somebody back here, right in front of you, Pete.
Thanks. My name is Yoni Bach. I'm an information officer at OFDA, and my question concerns the SERP, Commander's Emergency Response Program, which could potentially infuse up to $500 million for military commanders to make humanitarian decisions in the field. I guess my question is sort of broadly across the panel. To what extent has it been discussed in your various organizations? To what extent could it expand the humanitarian space into some of the red areas? And, you know, from the NGO perspective, is there a way for a commander emergency response program to coexist with CDR and NSP?
I do have a lot of experience on SERPs. I'll try not to be too long-winded on this question so we can get... This is a very complex and long issue. SERP was initially very small inputs of money to get away from the very cumbersome mechanism of ODACA, is the Commander's Emergency Response Fund, for small inputs to address, you know, those immediate hearts and minds type projects. And because the funding mechanism was so much quicker, everyone got in that, and now it's actually ramping up substantially. That SERP was one lane we did try to influence, and at different PRTs, at different regional commands, the interagency would have more or less input on how that money is spent. And that was a constant battle that we did have to say, look, you don't want to take that SERP fund and do that school there. That will create conflict. That will be an issue. So that's why I think we need to be engaged on that discussion to acknowledge that they have this pot of money. They are going to spend this. How to do it in the most appropriate way. And when we do have that discussion, to be fair, our military partners, they crave that discussion. They say, well, thank you. Come in, talk to us about this. What's appropriate? What's not appropriate? We won't do it if you're saying this is going to create all this problem. So I think there's a way to manage that. You know, I wouldn't say it's the preferred mechanism, but I would say that there's a way to manage that if it's going to occur, and it's just a question of balance and what resonates with the local population.
It's a huge asset. We need that kind of liquidity. It has to be more flexible so it moves to the people that have the greatest knowledge on the ground. And we have such an asymmetry of resources on the ground that we don't have enough civilians out there ever to really be able to provide the kind of insight. But we should be able to move that money also through some of our international partners, because that provides additional civilian insights, which are of huge value. So it's a great asset, but I don't think it's yet as valuable as it could be in light of the potential that it presents. And it reflects sort of our stovepipe thinking in our government, and also in the way we deal with our international partners. So some of our own internal weaknesses are really, really show up in a real place like this.
One thing to Rick's point, which I would agree with completely, the SERP fund is generous. I mean, it has, as Rick said, it's very well funded. The NSP, on the other hand, is in deficit $43 million. And as it goes into the second phase, the money allocated for the second phase has gone into to fund the rest of the first phase. The potential for impact vis-a-vis the local population is so much greater than I would suggest than the SERP can do, just because it is attached to the local population. So therefore, our allocation of funds and redirecting it somewhat, I think, is should be put on the table.
Now, Kim raised the really important point of transaction costs, and we've done a lot of work in this area showing how inefficient our own government spending is in Iraq in particular. And so when you see a transaction cost that is, you know, 63%, I think is what she said, reaches the people, we've got to move in that direction, in particular in these high-danger zones. So we're going to have to go to more direct transfers, and we're going to have to spend less time. We have to think about this, as our report suggested, as venture capital. It's going to hit some wrong people. It's going to miss some targets, but we will get a higher yield if we think of it that way, and we find ways to get it directly to the people. And that also relates to programs like WFP that have been moving a commodity to people. We also have to find other ways of getting people food that aren't necessarily commodity based, as we've done in most of our societies as well. So I mean, these are changes, fundamental changes in our approach that have to be considered in these places, or we're never going to succeed.
Yeah. Just very quickly, there's a strange phenomenon going on in Afghanistan right now. There's jealousy being built up between provinces. I was in Dikundi 2 weeks ago, and the provincial authorities complained bitterly that because they don't have Dikundi's the northern part of what was Oruzgan before, complaining bitterly because they don't have any insecurity problems. They're being shortchanged on funds that would typically come to them. Bamiyan has complained bitterly that they have the New Zealand PRT, which is a poor PRT. It doesn't have nearly as much money as if they had an American PRT there.
Yeah, just very quickly, Kim, I really think it would be very interesting to look at the kind of work that the community-driven reconstruction is doing and looking at it at a more macro level, what the implications are for overall priority setting, either in Afghanistan or other post-conflict situations, which is what Interpeace does, which is who I work with. But my question is really to both Rick, John, and Kim, and Eric all mentioned language as a major problem in terms of communicating. One, how real is that problem? And two, is anybody looking at developing an actual course in terms of teaching language that is common across the agencies, across the military, across the NGOs? Is anybody, because language acquisition is certainly a field that there's been a lot of work on, is anybody actually doing anything about it in this case, and why not?
I see it on the slides in different forums, whether it's USG or the military, that talks about cultural language. And I think as part of some of the interagency trainings on this, this issue is addressed. How do we speak to each other? It works itself out practically or does not on the ground when we have that relationship, with people. So I think, back to one of your original points, Rick, I think a lot of things are still not defined in this context, even though the debate's been going on for a while. And I think that applies to that many of these issues are still personality-driven. I hate to put that out there, but in a sense, it depends on the ground. You can get a really good commander that's really switched on, really engaged, and same with the interagency partners that actually do talk to each other rather than past each other. But that's also spotty. Then in other areas, people will go back to their fallback position in their culture and in their language. And I think in even if you look at the DoD Directive 3005, that will also define humanitarian assistance much differently than we would. So, that's the trained military has very good trainings, two-week-long trainings, on a specific topic. So that's there. So, but if we're not engaged on that, I think, the language issue is still an ongoing problem.
Actually, I just wanted excellent question. When I came back, visit my family in upstate New York, I was using words, acronyms like COA, Course of Action, and my family's looking at me like I have horns growing out of my head. But by the way, anybody after this wants to see me, I've got this great document I can email you that's goes through a ton of acronyms, just for the basics about acronyms and jargon. It really helps. In fact, I bought a book called, I think it was like Military for Dummies at Borders before I went to Afghanistan. It still didn't help very much because every different unit has their own language. In fact, when we brought up some SF warrant officers up to USAID and the Office of Military Affairs briefed, and they said DA a lot. USAID's understanding of DA is development assistance. Understanding of SF world is something a little bit different. Direct action, which is usually a Barrett 50 cal sniper rifle. So the reason I'm trying to inject a little funniness into this, but also want to lead to the next point. It's not just about verbal lexicon that's the problem. It's cultural as well. I mean, I'm coming off a little defensive about the military here, but on the flip side, when I've been embedded, sometimes some of the Project SERP, it's just you scratch your head as a civilian, like, oh my God, didn't they get training before they deployed, about cultural awareness, et cetera. I mean, and how to deal with, I bring an implementer part, I bring IOM in to a meeting and they're just completely talking past each other. It's just, it indicates there's big cultural misunderstanding of each other's worlds. And I really think that we could avoid a lot of the problems or perceptions of problems that we have downrange in military parlance or in the field if we just have more exposure to each other. Unfortunately, the exposure that's happening out there is in the field where maybe not the nicest sides of any of us ever really come out, and that does a disservice to it. But you're right. I'm maybe playing too much focus on this point. It's not really talking about security and access, but I actually think this is one of the most important issues that we're facing right now, and I don't quite know how to get around it aside from giving you Army for Dummies and just having an open mind. That's what I tell the military down at Bragg all the time. Have an open mind. You know, they're not all tree huggers. You know, some of them are, you know, but they're doing things that you couldn't only dream of doing. So be nice, play nice, and let's work together.
Eric, I think we have time for two more questions. If you provide us with your lexicon or whatever you're calling it, we'll post that on our blog for those of you who don't. Then we'll provide the link to the copyrighted site or whatever it is. But I thought when you'd asked the question that you were asking also about the Afghan language, which I think is a much greater problem in almost every one of these places, because we just don't have enough people who can speak in the context of the place, let alone with it amongst ourselves. So let's go to Sepeda, and then I think Ray, and if we have time, if they make their points or their questions really quick. Okay, all right, sorry about that.
Hi, I'm Sepeda Kevanshat, USAID. I have a quick comment and then a question. The comment I have is we've talked about unpredictability and the shifting of funds. And the comment on that is partly because we do not have a sufficient prioritization of what we want to do in Afghanistan right now. And I think this is what leads to the shifting of funds. This is understandable given that Afghanistan is a huge country with huge needs and things pop up all the time. But I think part of the reason we can't necessarily be all that predictable is emergencies come up all the time. Our latest emergency has been power in Kabul. We don't want the lights to go off, so we have to shift our resources. So that's just my comment, and basically to say it would be great if the Afghan government itself does a better prioritization of its priority, of its needs. And we have the Afghanistan National Development Strategy. There are a lot of priorities in there, and they're not necessarily, you know, numbered. So that was a comment. The question is about the NSP, and this kind of goes back to the creation of expectations. My understanding of the NSP, and this is probably for you because you seem to have done some kind of an assessment of this, my understanding is that NSP phase one is over, which means that those communities, they had a one-shot deal to get resources, and now we're going to NSP two, which means there is a new series of communities that are going to get resources. Now we have built this expectation that these people are going to, you know, they have developed these councils. What is going to happen to them at that point? Because, you know, we have been building expectations from the beginning. We don't want to keep doing that.
Excellent. Yes. Leads right in. Before I answer your question, I just wanted to also let you know that there's the report, the paper that I wrote is here. And you have three choices. You have the full version, you have the abridged version, or you have just the conclusion, which is 2.5 pages. So,
do you want me to model them for you?
And maybe we could put these on the, yeah. We'll put those on, but also there's a few copies here. The whole process of a CDR program itself is meant to begin to have the community as the locus for its own decision making over forever. I mean, so it's meant to begin to increase attention to CDCs and use of CDCs or something thereof to for government interaction with the communities and so forth. So you're absolutely right. The first phase actually went through about 50% of the population, 50% of the communities in the country in every province. So now it's on to the second phase. And those first ones are now graduating. So they've gone through the experience. They've had a, you know, wonderful interaction with each other. They've gone through the democratic process. By and large, it's been hugely successful. And everybody's sitting there, okay, you know, we're all primed. We're ready to go. What's next? And IRC is looking for its own sources of money. A lot of non-governmental organizations are doing the same thing. And the government is as well. MRRD is trying specifically to get money to continue this process with the graduated communities as even these new ones come on. But because NSP is unfunded, and as you say, what is the priorities here for the U.S. government in your comment earlier, I would suggest, you know, it's not very difficult, and I've spent a fair bit of time in a number of countries, to see that this meets a lot of U.S. government's own strategic priorities. Governance, stability, security, addressing needs, transition, da-da-da-da-da, that the U.S. government would support what the Afghan government is wanting. I agree with you that the priorities ranking within that ANZ is not very clear. But this gets at so many of them. And unfortunately, the U.S. contribution to the NSP has been very, very minimal. The next part of this is that there are other opportunities. If this is a platform for continued development, using the communities as the voice of need and so forth, international NGOs can access them, PRTs can access them, other donors can put funds into the NSP, but into the same process. So therefore, use a community-driven mechanism, which is already pre-established, for their operational platform on any sector, for any needs. And certainly, which is an interesting thing that's been going on in Panjshir, is community's own collection of resources, so it can continue the process. So it can say, okay, well, we got to priority 1, 2, and 3, but how about 4? And start collecting funds and using their own mechanisms and going out and seeking money as well to address their needs. So it's an ongoing discussion, and it's certainly World Bank says if it's a community's gone through about 6 years of a program like this, it's pretty well established in the community. And unfortunately, most of these have only gone through about 3 years, and only will unless we get more funding.
For others who have reports that they'd like us to link this event to on our blog, just please let us know afterwards. And Seema, you can also write our blog, which if you can't remember, pcrproject.com, you just go to the CSIS website and find it. But we'll be happy to post any reports that are out there and provide the links, because essentially what we're just trying to do is build community on these issues. So we'd be happy to do that, and we already have the link to your report, so we can do that. Ray Jennings, you get the last word, which should be a good one.
Boy, that's a lot to live up to. Ray Jennings, Wilson Center. Thanks for these great comments and presentations. It's really nice to have an operational discussion. I don't think there are enough operational discussions in this town. And thanks for the maps. And one of the things I notice on these maps is the red areas happen to be along the Pakistan border. There must be some relationship with that, I imagine. So my first question is, to what degree are you able to address some of the underlying factors to instability and insecurity that you're contending with that are originating in Pakistan? Is there any cross-border collaboration, cooperation, intelligence that you're able to build in to the work you do, or at least that informs the work you do? And secondly, I was on the World Bank team that designed the National Solidarity Program 2001. So it's great to see enthusiasm for it. And that's just precisely what our guess was, that 5 to 6 years in, we would want to graduate and make fully independent these community councils. The idea, frankly, was to have the line budget of Afghanistan fund this fully. But part of the problem is the Afghan government is not able to get enough customs revenue, enough income, to generate a budget large enough to fully fund the NSP out of the line budget, the national budget, and because of insecurity, frankly. So it's a little bit of a cyclical problem. But to answer or make a comment on an earlier question, one of the things that the parliament in Afghanistan is thinking about doing right now, because there's a less developed sense of what should happen at the and formal authority structures at the district and local level is to make the community councils that were developed in the NSP into some kind of formal, recognized Afghan government entity, which is a good recognition of what the NSP has accomplished, I thought. But the question I had to follow up, Kim, was how are the councils and how is the NSP going to deal with kind of scaling up the clustering process from the strictly local approach to something more regional or provincial? But normally that's kind of a graduation process as well. So some comments and questions thrown in there. But thank you again. This has been very enlightening.
I'll be fast, I promise, because most of what I know about Pakistan I can't talk about in the room. I'm looking at some faces right now that would end me. But I was working down, and this is no secret, in a place called Firebase Bermel and Firebase Shkin along the border with Pakistan and Paktika province. It's across from Miram Shah and Wana, across from a lot of unsavory elements. In the area, very confused PAK mil, Pakistani military, in terms of those we would meet with now and then that were quite cooperative in trying to establish some sense of border security. But the border, but then there's also some other elements, official and unofficial, that really made us confused about our partner in the war on terror on the other side of the border. Especially since they sometimes wore uniforms. To go into any further detail, and don't worry, I'm not going to just dangle that out there and yank it away, but I can't get into further detail about the Pakistani elements specifically that I'm talking about. But the complicated issue that we faced on that border is that we were primarily dealing with Waziris, and who the majority of their tribal structure was actually across the border in Pakistan. So whenever we held shuras or were dealing with anybody about security and stability, community engagement, you name it, the people that we dealt with were not calling the shots in the tribal system. Those that were higher up the chain in the broader Waziri tribal structure were actually on the other side. And either for reasons of conviction, either they were threatened, who knows. Your guess is as good as mine because I've never met them face-to-face, they wouldn't engage, and in many cases undermine our efforts to work with the lower elements of that broader tribe. So community engagement, we tried to do it. We actually got aid programs to work down there. We even got IOM to come down, believe it or not. They got in trouble for getting on a plane with us, with UNSICORD. But we did good work, but it was constantly undermined by forces across the border. And this is not just in Shkin and Bermel. This is happening all along the border. And the chain of command is aware of this. It's no secret. U.S. government's aware of it. There's no conspiracy here going on. It's just reality of this largely lawless area. I'm going to leave the comment on Pakistan with one final note. You know, those of you who know Seth Jones at RAND or a few New York Times reporters that are tracking this issue right now, there is a bit of confusion on exactly who's pulling the strings about the official elements on the border. If it's Musharraf, ISI, et cetera. I'm just throwing that out there. I have my own inklings, but that won't be discussed here. It's incredibly hard, and I don't envy anybody who's going to try to do anything CDC-like on that border. It's almost impossible. And it's just until that border, until we actually have a program that looks at the other side of the border, just throwing that out there in the room, we're just going to be banging our heads against the wall. Everything we do is going to be eroded. It's going to be like a tide, and everything we achieve is going to go away. And I'm talking about that 10 to 15 kilometer stretch. I'm not talking about whole districts. That specific stretch, where people can come in and go back out, and we can't do anything about it, at least kinetically or officially. So it's a problem. It's just a it's incredibly difficult for aid alone. I'm not forget even humanitarian organizations to work there, and it's incredibly difficult for civil affairs teams and for even SERP to be working there. Everybody wants a contract, and we really doubt that people have the best interests of their own people at heart in the Shuras. So that's it.
Okay, 1 minute. Two points. One is that there is a lot of consideration now being given to doing NSP-like type of program in Fatah, in the federally administrated territory, specifically to link up the populations who do go back and forth and are familiar on both sides. But lastly, your question of how do the CDCs, which are the community level, link up to the local government. Right now there's a process of clustering where communities are voting one woman and one man up to a cluster, which then relates to the district development assemblies, which are being formed with the help of UNDP, and those then link up to the provincial development councils. It's all sort of on the books, and we'll see how well it works, but that's the plan. Thank you, Rick.
Great. Well, thank you all. Please join me in thanking this excellent panel, and thank you.